This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of November and first weekend of December 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. A last-minute loophole that could undermine a Texas law against surprise medical bills.
Legislators wanted to give patients a win-win. And now some patients are going to get a lose-lose.
Hill Country landowners who say the energy company Kinder Morgan is lowballing them on land for a natural gas pipeline.
Once that pipe is in the ground, we live with it forever.
And some Texas farmers going all in on hemp.
We have an opportunity here to have a crop that can actually betterment their fields, and betterment their soil, and betterment their livelihoods.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend.
Oh, I was very, very, very thankful given the season. Couldn't come at any better time right before Thanksgiving. Gives us one more thing to be thankful for.
That's Ahmed Zatari. He is a plaintiff in a lawsuit against the city of Austin over its rules on short-term rentals, the places he rent out on websites like Airbnb. This week, the Texas Third Court of Appeals ruled that parts of the ordinance violate the Texas Constitution, specifically the provisions that ban Type 2 STRs. Now, those are the ones where the owner does not live on site. The city of Austin stopped issuing new permits for Type 2 STRs a few years ago and has been planning to phase them out. But the court said those rules unconstitutionally restrict well-recognized property rights while serving a minimal, if any, public interest. And the court also overturned rules limiting how many people can be at an STR, saying those regulations infringe on Texans' fundamental right to assemble on private property.
If I were to give the city some advice, I would ask them to stop their unjust attack against short-term rental managers and short-term rental owners. Really try to enforce the current rules, because there's a lot of people that are playing by the book that they're essentially targeting. And there's a lot of people that aren't, and they're not enforcing the rules that they're on the book. So essentially, it's an enforcement problem of nuisance laws and rules that are already on the book. So just enforce those.
Austin City Councilmember Kathy Tova was instrumental in getting the STR rules passed in 2016, and she says she was surprised by the ruling, and not pleasantly so.
I would take a step back and say the council very rightly made a distinction between residential properties that are used by homeowners as short-term rentals for a very limited period each year, and properties that are really serving a commercial purpose. And those short-term rental twos, which are the ones the court was responding to, are commercial properties. And, you know, within most municipalities, they make distinctions between commercial uses and residential uses, which is what we did. So I think the court got it wrong. I think they're classifying short-term rental twos as primarily residential in nature is just incorrect. It overlooks really the nature of that business, which is to serve as a hotel 100% of the time.
Councilmember Tovo says she will encourage the city's legal department and her fellow city council members to consider appealing this ruling to the Texas Supreme Court. Bipartisan efforts in Texas to shield patients from surprise medical bills could be weaker than lawmakers intended when they go into effect on January 1st. Consumer advocates say a proposed rule could severely weaken the legislation by continuing to allow surprise bills outside of emergencies. KUT's Ashley Lopez explains.
Earlier this year, lawmakers from both parties came together to work on outlawing surprise medical bills for as many Texans as they could. Senate Bill 1264 created an arbitration process for insurers and providers to negotiate prices in situations where patients with state-regulated health plans unknowingly get out-of-network care. Right now, when both sides can't agree, patients get stuck with some outrageous bills. Stacey Pogue with the Center for Public Policy Priorities says the fact that the legislature agreed on a way to fix this is historic.
I haven't seen
a bill with a scope this big, that it could be this meaningful for the financial security of a family, pass in the 12 years I've been doing this.
But that protection could soon be at risk in non-emergency situations. That's because of a provision in the bill that created a narrow exception for people who knowingly want to receive care from a doctor out of their health plan's network.
The financial struggle that legislators were trying to remove us from, they're trying to protect us from, patients might be right back in the middle of that situation.
After a law is passed, it's up to the agencies that will enforce it to write up the rules for implementation. And when the Texas Medical Board went through its rulemaking process, they proposed the rules advocates are concerned about. Stacey Pogue and others are specifically concerned about a rule that would require all out-of-network providers in non-emergency situations to give patients a form that could, in practice, waive their rights to not get a surprise bill.
It's a loophole. It's a loophole in the protection where legislators wanted to give patients a protection, a win-win. And now some patients are going to get a lose-lose. They're going to have a scheduled procedure and be asked to essentially choose between two terrible outcomes.
That's a choice between paying more for providers they didn't choose or canceling or delaying a needed medical procedure. The Texas Medical Board, by the way, doesn't see it this way. In a statement, a spokesperson said the proposed rules do not, quote, waive any rights a patient has under Senate Bill 1264 or any statute. The spokesperson continues to say the board created rules it believes, quote, provides patients with enough advance notice to make a reasoned economic decision in regards to the care they are receiving.
They're leaving a lot of questions unanswered and creating a lot of concern about how this is all going to play out.
That's Blake Hudson with the AARP of Texas. He says the good news is people in emergency situations will definitely be shielded from surprise medical bills starting January 1st. But it's not clear whether people not in emergencies will get the same amount of protection. Hudson says allowing providers and not patients to choose when to use the waiver could create widespread abuse of what was supposed to be a narrow exception.
It looks like what they're going to do is let your surgeon or whoever works at the front desk include in your packet a form that essentially waives your surprise medical bill protections for all of those out-of-network physicians.
That could be the anesthesiologist or pathologist, basically any of the different people involved in your procedure.
And that's a really big concern for consumers and definitely is not the intent of Senate Bill 1264, and everyone that was involved in the process of developing this law knows that.
Other stakeholders have also raised concerns about this proposed rule. In a statement, the Texas Association of Health Plans said the rule misinterprets the law's intent and actually makes surprise billing protections weaker than they were before the law was passed. State Senator Kelly Hancock, a Republican from North Richland Hills, sponsored SB 1264. He says the intent of the legislation was to protect every Texan with a state-regulated health insurance plan from getting a surprise bill, period. And he says he will not accept an outcome in the rulemaking process that doesn't reflect that.
And so we have no intentions of seeing the efforts and the intentions of legislators being ignored just because associations want to get things their way.
But State Representative Tom Oliverson, a Republican from Cypress who co-sponsored the bill, says he's not as concerned with the proposed rules. He said the waiver process included in the bill was supposed to be something that was rarely used. And Oliverson, who is an anesthesiologist in Texas, thinks providers won't abuse that. And if they do, he said, lawmakers will get rid of that exception in 2021. But that's what some healthcare advocates say they don't want. They say they don't want to go through this again. Blake Hudson says SB 1264 was painfully created, and lawmakers took the time to find a compromise with both insurers and providers, which was no easy task.
You know, there's a lot of money in healthcare, and so the different interests are going to use whatever they can to keep collecting money on the backs of consumers wherever they can, unfortunately. It's frustrating.
The proposed rules are expected to be discussed during the board's upcoming meeting in early December and could possibly be adopted as early as then. Either way, the new law is set to be in effect January 1st. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
More people are signing on to the idea that parts of Austin's east side need to be protected in the city's rewrite of its land development code. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey explains.
This is all part of the city's attempt to allow for more housing in Austin by rewriting the rules that govern what can be built in your neighborhood. Mayor Pro Tem Delia Garza wrote on the council message board that she was, quote, deeply concerned about the idea that Austin should adopt the same building rules for all residential parts of the city, saying that does not address historical wrongs.
It hasn't been fair that East Austin has taken the bulk of our housing capacity, that it's been pushed east of 35. And if we are truly considering equity in these discussions, we need to think about our history.
Garza has proposed drawing boundaries, if you will, around gentrifying areas, in the hope that it could discourage the demolition of existing affordable apartments and encourage the building of more affordable housing in these areas. All ideas the city's planning commission has had as well. Council members will likely discuss this before they take the first vote on the new land code December 9th. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
A study out this week suggests that Texas courts do not collect fines and fees efficiently. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, that leads to more defendants serving jail time in lieu of paying debt they cannot afford.
The Brennan Center for Justice analysis of courts in 10 counties in New Mexico, Florida, and Texas found the overall funding model for courts isn't cost-effective. In Texas, especially so. For example, in Travis County, courts spent 35% of the money they were eligible to collect in 2017 on the actual administrative process of collecting that debt from defendants. Matt Menendez authored the study. He says on top of that, people can't afford to pay, and the amount of uncollected court debt has ballooned over the last few years to nearly $18 million.
Despite the very large amounts taken in, there were very large amounts that were uncollected every year, and the balance has just been growing, which strongly suggests that these fees and fines are being imposed without regard to whether or not people can actually pay them.
Menendez says low-income defendants often serve jail time instead of paying a fine, which adversely affects future opportunities for employment and housing. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
The city of Austin has plans to improve in the Red River Cultural District sidewalks, lighting, landscaping, and other aspects of the outdoor built environment there. Chad Switecki with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor, has been covering this. Hello, Chad.
Hi, Nathan.
So what's happening with the Red River Cultural District?
For a number of years now, the business owners down there have been kind of clamoring for some improvements to the streetscape and safety and accessibility. I wouldn't call it hazardous, but it's not exactly the most welcoming and thoughtfully constructed and styled pedestrian environment. And so you're having some progress on getting that work done. There was quite a bit of attention paid over the summer to some work that was done to seal off and clean up an alley between 7th and 8th Street that had become a problem area for, let's just call it, vice and criminal activity. So that has been addressed to much happiness by the business owners, but the city has committed $1.3 million from Great Streets program to start working on the other improvements, with a report due in a couple of months, kind of detailing the possible timeline, priorities, and just a general plan for how they'll go about carrying out these improvements.
You write a little bit in your piece at austinmonitor.com about what types of things this $1.3 million from the Planning and Zoning Department will go towards. Can you give us an idea, you know, people who go down to Red River, what kind of changes might they see in the months ahead?
I think it'll certainly be more welcoming and more safe. Accessibility is a big component. When I spoke with the director of the Economic Development Department, she said that the safety and accessibility are the two biggest factors that are going to go into prioritizing the projects that happen. So I think you're going to see some cleaning up and repair of sidewalks, more lighting, better signage, help people get around better. And then you get to probably the landscaping, maybe some planters. There's going to be more trash receptacles. So just kind of the things that you don't really think about, but can lend to the overall hospitality and inviting nature of good streetscape environments.
One of the big venues on Red River has been Beerland, which has been through a little bit of turmoil lately.
You're reporting now that there's some changes in the works for Beerland. What have they been through and what's coming down the road?
The venue, which had been a kind of a very well-known and well-acknowledged incubator for underground, kind of punk rock type of bands, broadly speaking, closed rather suddenly at the end of May. It had been an underperforming place monetarily for a number of years, but it had been kept open by its ownership. But it closed in May and was purchased recently by a couple of gentlemen who are general managers over at the Stubbs Amphitheater up the street. And so they have been working for the past 6 weeks or so to do a pretty significant remodel inside, making it a more, I guess, lounge kind of venue. It'll still have music about 100 nights per year rather than 250 to 300 nights per year as Beerland did. So music will be a component, but it's going to be more of a bar lounge environment going forward.
Will the music tone be shifting at all?
That is still kind of to be determined. They're going to be using outside promoters to do their scheduling and booking. But one of the gentlemen, Ned Stewart, who himself was a musician who had played Beerland several times, told me, you know, he's still a fan of loud rock and roll and wants that kind of music to be a part of the Beerland ethos going forward. Though it's also going to be determined a lot by who shows up, who comes out to the shows that they do start programming, and what do the audiences want? So it certainly seems a rock and roll of a loud and hopefully adventurous nature will be part of what happens at Beerland, though in a more limited calendar situation.
And what is the thinking behind dialing back the number of live shows they have? A more than 50% reduction in the number of nights they have live music per year.
There's the simple fact that when you've got a standing room only venue, Beerland could hold 170 people standing for shows. But when you have 170 people standing, it's a lot easier for them to walk out and go somewhere else. Whereas if you have a lounge concept, I mean, where people are at benches and tables and just congregating and just having a little bit more of a social glue kind of situation, those types of bar environments tend to keep people around longer, and it's easier to serve kind of the higher price point drinks that are more profitable rather than $2 and $3 Lone Stars that kind of had been one of the hallmarks of Beerland. So just the pure economics of how and where people like to purchase mixed drinks, wine, and the higher price point things play into what they want to do business-wise with Beerland going forward.
Chad Switecki with our reporting partner, the Austin Monitor. You can read his story about the plans for Red River streetscape improvements at austinmonitor.com. And check out his new website reporting on Austin music, news, and culture for more about Beerland's new beginning. That site is noisesandsignals.com. Chad, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Nathan.
Fredericksburg rancher Kay Pence got a call about a year ago from the pipeline company Kinder Morgan. They told her they planned to run part of a big gas pipeline through her ranch. Problem is, Pence didn't want it.
As a landowner, you felt, I mean, this is going to sound overreactive, but you felt violated.
That's because in Texas, pipeline companies can use eminent domain powers to take private land. They just need to pay what's deemed a fair price. But that can be hard to agree on. Now, some landowners, like Pence, are rejecting the company's offers and going to what's called a condemnation hearing. These hearings are happening all over the Hill Country. So KUT's Mose Bushell went to Pence's place in Fredericksburg to learn more about what happens when a landowner takes on a pipeline company.
The thing I want you to keep in mind is how much is at stake. For landowners, winning these hearings is a matter of pride, but also a lot of money is on the line. Kay Pence's hearing starts at 9 a.m. By the end of the day, millions will be won or lost, depending on how you look at it. So it's surprising how casual the whole thing feels. It all happens in this little banquet room at a roadside motel. There's coffee and kolaches in the back. Townspeople come in to watch. They greet Kay Pence and her husband, Charlie.
Yes. Everyone knows everybody.
It doesn't feel like a legal proceeding until you look to the front of the room. There, in one corner, three men sit at a fold-out plastic table. They're dressed in small-town Texas pressed Wranglers style. They're older. One of them has his cowboy hat set in front of him. These men are local people, too. But today, they're also the most powerful people in this room. They're serving as special commissioners, kind of like a jury. They're volunteers who've been chosen by a judge to settle this dispute. And facing the commissioners, in the other corner, lawyers in suits. Lawyers for Kinder Morgan and lawyers for Kay Pence.
Raise your right hand. Do you affirm to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth today?
I do.
But wait, before we get to the hearing, a few quick details. When Kay Pence got that call from Kinder Morgan, she says they offered her $45,000 for a 3-acre slice of land to put the pipeline under. Her ranch is 105 acres, and it sounds kind of swanky. It's got an equestrian center, a vineyard. Kay and her husband believed the ranch to be worth $4 million. They thought the company's offer was all wrong.
They own that easement in perpetuity. They have access to it. They can sell it. They can change product. They can do all kinds of things.
The Pences considered the pipeline's impact on the price of the whole ranch and came up with a much larger number. This happens a lot in these cases. Pipeline companies want to pay just for the land they're going to use. Landowners want compensation for the damage to the whole place.
Once that pipe is in the ground, we live with it forever. Their shareholders get quarterly dividends. We receive a one-time payment.
So what do they want that payment to be? Like I said, Kinder Morgan offered around $45,000. The Pences wanted $1.8
million. Raise your right hand.
So now, let's get back to the hearing.
The whole truth, nothing but the truth today.
I do.
It starts with a lawyer. So a lawyer from Kinder Morgan tells commissioners what they're here to do and what they're here not to do. He wants them to know that this is not a referendum on the pipeline. This isn't even about eminent domain. He tells them they have just one job, and that is to come up with a number.
Just compensation.
Just compensation for the Pences. The Pences lawyer agrees, then starts his case. He shows how the pipeline will cut through the ranch. Even after it's buried, workers will be able to come in and out of the ranch forever. That hurts the value of the whole property.
Could you please state your name for the record and introduce yourself to the commissioners, please, Nathan?
My name is Nathan Tony.
Next come the appraisers. The one from Kinder Morgan explains the company's offer. The Pences guy says how he got to his number. They're cross-examined.
How did you get that out of what I just said?
Well, I just want to make sure we're clear.
By now, there are about 40 people in the audience, and as the hours go by, they get a little more vocal, laughing and tisk-tisking some of the testimony. I start to wonder, why are they here? So during a break, I ask around. Kathy Shreenan says she's here to support the Pences. She's against the pipeline.
We all kind of have a dog in the fight. It's our community, and it's our neighbors, and it affects everything.
Same Shelley Wright.
It's the Edwards Aquifer. It's the Trinity Aquifer. It's our rivers. And so this is just really heart-wrenching.
And Kevin Booth.
That thing breaks. It's going to be a mushroom cloud.
Everybody I talk to is against the pipeline for all sorts of reasons. But they also think Kinder Morgan is seriously lowballing landowners.
These hearings and the way it's going, hopefully, are just keep making that price tag go up, 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 up.
And that's what's been happening. In the last few months, Hill Country landowners have been rejecting the company's offers and winning sums vastly greater at the hearings. One landowner was offered $37,000, but awarded almost $1.8 million. In another case, an offer of $85,000 turned into $11 million. The people I talked to said the company has no sense of the true value of the land. These awards are evidence Kinder Morgan is trying to take advantage of people, and that they're proof that the pipeline company has messed with the wrong small town. It's worth noting that the three people you just heard from had all volunteered to serve as special commissioners in other hearings.
I heard a rumor Kinder Morgan lawyers were complaining that they were being hometowned. So you came to a small German community where everybody's known each other for 120 years, and you're surprised that they're all communicating with what's happening? Yeah, so you're being hometown.
I asked a rep from Kinder Morgan about this last part. He told me that he wasn't aware of any lawyer saying this, and the company respects the hearing process.
30-second warning to the room. If you want to continue your conversation,
by now, it's mid-afternoon. People have been listening for hours, and it's finally time for the main event, Kay Pence's testimony. But first, she needs to get everyone's attention.
Hey, 30 seconds, we're going to start.
That does the trick.
I was a Girl Scout leader. I had to yell.
So she sits down at a table between the lawyers and the commissioners and starts to tell her story.
My name is Kay Pence. This is a very difficult thing for any landowner to have to sit here and do. My name is Kay Pence. I live at 75.
And her testimony is different, more personal. She talks about her husband's poor health, how they wanted to sell the ranch to downsize, but since the pipeline was announced, one buyer walked away and no one else is interested. She explains the sum she wants is how much she thinks they'll need to drop the price.
Thank you so much, and I pray to God you are never sitting here and facing someone there deciding what the value of your property is.
And that's it. The lawyers do closing statements. The commissioners head to a kitchen behind the room to settle on a number. People in the audience gather around the Pences, shake hands, give hugs. When the commissioners come back, most people don't seem to notice. Commissioners sign some papers, shake hands with the lawyers, and leave. No big announcement, no groans or cheers from the crowd, no public resolution at all. I find Kay Pence and ask how it went.
It went okay.
But she seems disappointed. Turns out, the commissioners decided that a fair price for her land was $1.2 million. That's almost 27 times what the company offered. But it's also a lot less than the amount she asked for.
Wasn't what we would have liked, but it's okay.
And it's not over. As long as Kinder Morgan puts this money in an account, something like an escrow account, it can continue building the pipeline while it appeals the award. So the whole thing could still end up at a jury trial. Kay Pence says the process could go on for years, but Kinder Morgan plans to have the pipeline moving gas by early 2021. That means the Pences could still be fighting the company over payment even after the pipeline is in the ground and running. Mose Bouchel, KET News.
Of the Texas House has released his list of interim charges, issues that lawmakers are assigned to study before the next legislative session at the beginning of 2021. KUT's Ben Philpott is here to talk to us about those. Hello, Ben.
Hello.
Tell us about these interim charges.
I think that the House interim charges are really very straightforward. I mean, they are, let's look at a lot of the bills that we passed in the last session, the most important bills we passed in the last session, and then let's just simply focus on things that we want to work on in the next session to help the state function better, different parts of state government to function better. Now, over the years, depending on just the political winds and who the speaker is or who the lieutenant governor is for the Senate, you know, you've had interim charges that have maybe been a little more politically charged. And we saw that even a little bit earlier in the year with the Senate's interim charges. They did have a handful of kind of Republican base red meat, you might call it, topics that just Republicans want to have addressed. The House version of the interim charges did not really go down that avenue. They did seem very much more straightforward, focusing on the business of the state. I mean, there is nothing on guns. There's nothing on abortion. There's nothing on border security. You know, the only border item that I could really find, other than, you know, looking back and studying past bills that have been passed, the only thing forward looking on the border was the idea of making the ports of entry within Texas work better. So things like maybe dredging the channels heading into Houston so that you can get more ships in and out more quickly to drop off items, and working on ways to reduce wait times at the border crossings, you know, from El Paso down to Brownsville.
So there's 49 pages worth of interim charges. What else is on that giant list?
The House did a lot on mental health in the last legislative session, the Senate as well. And so the House, you know, is asking its lawmakers to go back through and make sure that those bills are getting implemented the right way, and consider what kind of changes might need to be made in the next session to further the House's goal of improving and expanding mental health coverage within the state. You also had, of course, a lot of, wanting the House to check and see how the school finance bill that was passed in the last session, which gave several billion more to public schools, you know, check that, make sure that that's providing the kind of help or the kind of money that lawmakers thought it was going to. And you have that every session. I mean, the whole idea of, so we passed this bill, we want this bill to do blank. Does it do blank? Did it end up doing blank? If not, then let's, you know, have another bill ready to go in the next legislative session.
How important are these interim charges in determining what type of legislation the House will work on and maybe even pass in the next legislative session, which is more than a year away?
Any House member can file any bill they want, but because of the very short legislative session and because of the number of lawmakers, the bills that have a best chance to pass are the bills that are already deemed a priority when you start the legislative session. So January 2021, the bills that have the best chance to pass are those that have already been deemed a priority. And how do you get deemed a priority? If you're a bill that was generated from an interim charge during the year and a half before that legislative session. Not every single one of them will be necessarily deemed a priority come next legislative session, but this is the starting point, and this is where you can go ahead and be making your case and building your support. And then the committee reports, which come from this, those are turned into bills, and those are the things that are filed.
Does it matter at all that House Speaker Dennis Bonin is not seeking re-election and is not going to be around in the next legislative session?
Not exactly. I mean, it matters in that this new speaker could come in and have a completely different set of priorities based on, you know, what we're seeing in the interim charges. But then you have a new speaker who can shepherd through any of those new priorities at a much quicker pace than say, you know, a new elected person from Southwest Austin. So it does matter in that a lot of work is being done on these priorities. But a new speaker certainly has the ability to come in and say, some of these are great, and I have some other priorities that I think should also be addressed. And again, the speaker then has the power and the ability and the hands on the levers of the legislative session to get those new priorities through as quickly as an interim, something based on an interim charge.
And even Bonin could throw in some more stuff, right, if he wanted to?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is not in cement. Speaker Bonin could come back and say, yeah, let's think about other things. I mean, if you got other things that are kind of moving along that are separate from this. So I mentioned that there's no guns in this, gun legislation in
no
this.
No abortion, you said,
too. No abortion. But there is a select House and a select Senate committee on mass violence in Texas. And gun legislation, possibly some kind of reform on background checks or other items related to guns, could certainly flow out of those committees. And those, you know, that's not part of the interim charges, but those are things that could also flow through and be priorities. But at any moment, something could happen and the speaker, lieutenant governor, could say, you know, yeah, this actually also needs to be a priority. Here's an extra charge for you.
KUT's Ben Philpott, thanks so much for this, Ben.
Thank you.
Was legalized by the Texas legislature earlier this year, and now the state has to come up with a regulatory framework, partly to make sure farmers are growing hemp and not marijuana, which has more THC and gets you high and is still not legal in Texas. But in the meantime, some Texas farmers are going all in on hemp. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has that story.
Not every crop could compel farmers to pay $50 to spend a chilly weekday in a drab conference room in Wichita Falls, but hemp is not every crop. The 2018 Farm Bill cleared the way for farmers in Texas to finally grow the non-psychoactive cousin of marijuana after it was illegal for decades. We're still several months away from seeds legally going into the ground, but that hasn't stopped people like Chris Patillo from jumping aboard the hemp hype train.
All of our farmers are already hurting. We have an opportunity here to have a crop that can actually embetterment their fields, embetterment their soil, embetterment their livelihoods.
Patillo is one of the over 300 people who attended the Wichita Falls conference. He's the co-owner of the Wichita Falls, Texas Hemp Company, WFTHC. Get it? When we met, he was wearing a hat that said, "Make America Hemp Again."
45,000 different agricultural products that can be made out of it. We start to work on your pain with the CBD properties that everyone is now coming online and becoming familiar with. And then we're talking about a food source that has 427 nutrients, omega-3, 6, and 9 fatty acids. So now I'm fixing your health, I'm fixing your pocket, and I'm fixing your food. You're going to have to come up with new things to complain about.
Patillo's enthusiasm may be more breathless than most, but the sentiment is common. As CBD products have become ubiquitous, the value of hemp has skyrocketed. In states where it's been legal to grow for years, some farmers report profiting thousands of dollars per acre. Compare that to making around $100 per acre on a good cotton crop.
And this is one farmer's opinion in red.
Which is why there was barely a seat available inside the Wichita Falls conference room. The agenda included insight from agronomists like Calvin Trossel of Texas A&M. This is audio from his presentation. Most of the slides are what you might imagine. Data about seed prices, potential diseases, growing seasons. But then, he gets to one that doesn't seem to fit. A slide with three photos of emus. You know, the big Australian birds. Now, the question, why are emus being discussed at a hemp conference, is a valid one. But there is a good reason.
I think the hype is very similar.
That's also Trossel. In the 80s and 90s, emus were touted as an agricultural game changer in Texas, and they weren't a cheap investment.
Sometimes $20,000 for a breeding pair.
But the belief was that emu was going to be in freezers across America, right next to the ground beef. You could use their oil as a moisturizer or an anti-inflammatory. You could use their enormous blue eggs to make massive omelets. That was the pitch, at least. In the end, the market never really materialized.
So the birds became worthless, and the people that made money were the ones selling birds.
Meaning farmers lost money. Trossel's hope is that hemp doesn't become the next emu. There's a lot of promise right now, but also a lot of questions.
So what I'm telling my producers in my area is don't invest more than you're willing to lose.
That's Justin Benavides, an assistant professor and economist with the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension. There's not a lot of technical expertise here, and harvesting requires special equipment that's hard to find in Texas. It's also one thing to grow hemp, but then it has to be processed so that the fiber or CBD oil is usable. The problem right now is that there are no hemp processing facilities in Texas. There are rumors, preliminary plans for some, but according to Trossel,
we just don't know how many of these will actually come to fruition. I mean, a lot of it's talk. And when it really comes down to spending the money and saying, okay, do we really believe that we've got an opportunity here? That's where I think some of the talk's going to hit reality.
It's also not cheap or easy to grow. There are no approved pesticides or herbicides for hemp yet, so weed pulling has to be done by hand. And those huge profit margins? Increased supply is already cutting into them. Again, here's Justin Benavides, the agricultural economist.
When you have a massive run-up in supply and a stable processing capacity, then you see a decrease in price for a product. So that's a natural supply and demand force that we expect to see, and that's one of the concerns.
Experts like Trossel and Benavides are trying to make as many potential growers aware of these risks as possible. But even if farmers are fully mindful of them, some are still determined to give hemp a shot. That includes Houston Shores, a melon and vegetable farmer from Sunset, Texas, about 60 miles northwest of Fort Worth. Melon farming is not getting any easier. Shores says he's the last one doing it in his area. So hemp could give his operation a welcome boost. When I asked him about how serious he was about growing hemp, he said,
"Scale 1 to 10, a 10.
Shores insists he's going into this with eyes wide open. His first crop will be a small batch of test plants in his greenhouse, about 1 acre total. So he's starting small, not betting the farm. Still, he feels like he can't not try, given the profit potential.
I'm the biggest optimist there is. I mean, you have to get out there and you have to try new things, but just don't try it on a large scale where you go bankrupt.
Besides, it's unclear whether farmers will even have the opportunity to grow hemp this coming spring. If the state of Texas doesn't move quickly on its hemp rules, farmers won't have time to plant a crop for 2020. That means the questions about hemp in Texas may not be answered until 2021. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
That is KUT Weekend for the last weekend of November and first weekend of December 2019. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org, email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or just ask me on Twitter. I am @KUTNathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.